Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Now, my next guest is one of Britain's most celebrated and accomplished musicians. He was born into what became one of the country's most famous musical families. After taking up the cello, he won a scholarship to the Royal College of Music at the age of just 16. He's gone on to sell more than 100,000 records and play with the world's greatest orchestras and even busk on the tube, all in a career which spanned nearly five decades until it was sadly cut short by a slipped disc in his neck. Now he's channeling his creative energy towards the next generation of musicians. But you know, with all those achievements and all those amazing pieces of classical music that he's played, many of you may know him best of all for this. All I think about when I hear that is Melvyn Bragg's marvellous hair. I don't know why. Julian Lloyd-Webber, good afternoon, and thank you very much for joining me here on Times
Radio. Good
afternoon,
Mariella.
Lovely to talk to you.
Melvyn's hair is certainly better than mine.
Well, Melvyn's got very, very excellent hair, and I think he knows it. But let's not waste our entire time that we have to speak to each other on discussing Melvyn Bragg's amazing hair. Melvyn Bragg's amazing hair, even. So let's start instead where it all began with you, because it's so interesting to see. I mean, I know that many children rebel against what their parents do, but you and your brother Andrew clearly weren't that rebellious, because you seem to have actually just followed in their footsteps.
Well, I'm not sure about that, but I definitely rebelled against my mother, who was a specialist teacher of young children to the piano. And of course, she tried to teach me and I couldn't get on with it at all. So I was four then, though. but I she took me to a children's concert at the Royal Festival Hall in London, and I spotted the cello there in the orchestra. And I said, can I play one of those? Thinking, of course, that then I might be allowed to give up the piano, which is what happened. But there was a slight early rebellion there.
Because your father was a composer, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. He wrote beautiful music, but, you know, it was he was quite shy about it. It was at the time you weren't supposed to write melodies and things, and he basically hid most of it away.
So melodies were unfashionable, but you certainly made them very fashionable. Tell me a little bit about why you were interested in the cello, because that would seem like a strange choice. If you couldn't or didn't fancy the piano, embracing the cello is surely more difficult. Am I mad?
The funny thing is, you know, I was given a tent-sized cello to play because I was so young and I needed a smaller instrument. And it was very easy to embrace it. And in fact, that's one of the great things about the cello, isn't it? It's embraceable.
Well, it is quite literally, isn't it? It sort of it looks like it's made to be embraced. I guess, yes. You know, your career really took off because you were a precocious early talent. You were accepted to the Royal College of Music at the age of 16 and soon training among some of the world's most renowned musicians, including finishing your studies in Geneva with celebrated cellist Pierre Fournier. Did it feel overwhelming to you at the time? And did you already know? Because, you know, one of the things that you've done amazingly well is sort of popularise classical music and make people feel that it was accessible to them, that it wasn't some sort of rarefied form that you needed a beard to stroke to discuss.
Yeah, well, it's what I've always believed from the very beginning. You know, I love the music, so I wanted to bring it to as many people as possible. And it's, you know, one of the things that distresses me most now is that in so many schools, children have no access to music, sometimes absolutely no access at all. So they could actually go through the whole of their school life and never hear a note of what I would say is classical music. I mean, one shouldn't get too stuck on these terms. Classical music doesn't really mean very much because we're talking about over 1,000 years of music in completely different styles. But there's a whole area of music that perhaps children will never hear about at school. And I think that's really sad and wrong and actually tragic, because I think that the children of all backgrounds should have access to something that is so wonderful.
And what do you think they're missing? And, you know, any of us who aren't exposed to classical music are missing in that situation. What do you think it brings? I mean, I know that there's a huge sort of ethos now, isn't there, with the whole wellness business and everything, that, you know, classical music is very good for relaxing. But sort of classical purists get very angry about that, don't they?
Yes, I think classical music covers so many moods. I think that is what people are missing. Classical music can be a great solace to people. I mean, it's very interesting in the COVID time that the classical radio stations and things reported hugely increased listening figures, more in relation to other stations. So people seem to turn to that music as a form of solace and something that... And I think that is what's so important, that music, and music means many things to many people, and everyone carries this kind of soundtrack with them, music that they love and have loved maybe from an early age. And that's where I was so fortunate to be exposed to many, many different kinds of music. And I love not only classical music, but lots of different kinds of music that I really like. But I think it's the classical music that is missing in particularly in schools. And so there's a huge amount of wonderful art, really, that children are just not having the experience of hearing.
Classical music is also often presented. I mean, I wonder, do you think that term is out of date?
Yes, I think classical is kind of doesn't really mean anything. But then there's the debate, well, what do you call it then? And I think there is some kind of thing that you can recognise classical music. Maybe it's the instruments that are being used. You know, you can hear, there's some guy on the internet out there who's arranged lots of Shostakovich's string quartets for electric guitars. And it sounds kind of completely different. So, which, as you imagine, it might. But it's interesting that he can do that and that it actually works. And so it's often about instrumentation. Orchestral instruments equals classical, I suppose. There's also an element that it's notated, it's written down. So it's kind of there.
It's precise, it's demanding or strict, yeah, or something.
There is a kind of a... I don't know. I mean, you know, this is the danger of generalization, because there's all kinds of composers now that would incorporate improvisation like jazz into their compositions. But basically, there is a structure, perhaps, to classical music that defines it and its instrumentation as well.
It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, the electric guitars and Shostakovich, because I think one of the things that people don't necessarily think of classical music as being is a sort of live performance music. Although lots of people do go and watch classical orchestras and so on, but I think, you know, you sort of think it's not very Glastonbury, is it? But I wondered what you feel about that. I mean, I think your professional debut was in 1972 when you gave a performance at the Queen Elizabeth Hall here in London. You would have been, what, 21 at the time. Do you remember the feeling of stepping out on the stage? And do you think that it is very much about performance as well as playing? Like, performance doesn't necessarily just mean what you play.
I think it's totally, well, very much about performance. And I certainly remember stepping out on that stage and every other time as well. You know, there's this incredible adrenaline. And the thing I missed most when I had to stop was that incredible contact with an audience. You know, it's a real kind of spiritual connection. And I think, also, I disagree about Glastonbury. I'd love to see a full symphony orchestra out there. There is something incredible about that number of musicians, 100 musicians on stage, conductor, soloist, you know, bringing their music to an audience. And I think people perhaps who haven't been really need to experience that. It's something very, very special.
But in fact, I mean, I'm not saying that there shouldn't be classical music at Glastonbury. I think it'd be really, really exciting to see a classical orchestra somewhere like that. And I suppose that also speaks to your mission to bring classical music to younger people. Do you think that there's a sort of a degree of conservatism in the approach, you know, that one form of music shouldn't be allowed to mix with another form?
Well, I've kind of fought against that all my life, but I think it's very good that classical music can be heard in different surroundings. You know, I mean, there are orchestras going out there in playing in car parks and things, and whether that works or not, I wouldn't like to say, but there are definitely, we could try different venues and different places and even in the clubs and things. I think it's really important because, you know, we're not just something preserved in aspic, you know, we are part of a living culture, and we have to be.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Julian, you clearly are passionate about your playing and about classical music, but perhaps, you know, more so than anything, passionate about playing the cello. And you've premiered more than 50 works over your career, but it all came to a sudden end in 2013 during a performance at an event in Suffolk when, I think, 10 minutes into it, your bowing arm lost all its power. Do you remember that moment? And what sort of thoughts were going through your head? I mean, it must have been really your worst nightmare realised.
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've been doing. I was probably, I don't know how old exactly then, 63 or something. I've been playing all my life and I'm in the middle of a concert. Not even the middle, as you say, about 10 minutes into it. And I suddenly, you know, I can't hold the bow. I'm going to drop the bow. I mean, it was the most ridiculous feeling. And at first, I just knew it was really bad.
I got
through to the, because it's. I think you know if something's really wrong with your body. And I, at that moment, I thought, well, I can't. It's so embarrassing. I had to go to the organizer of the concert. We were doing this huge sonata by Rachmaninoff in the second half, which is flat out for 40 minutes. You know, and I said to him, I'm not sure I can finish the concert. And I did finish the concert. I mean, and I soldiered on. Luckily, I was doing a concert tour with my wife for music for two cellos. And it was much lighter. Well, I don't mean light, but not such tough.
Not so demanding.
So, no. And so I was able to go on and all the time kept having these different treatments and seeing specialists and things. And none of them wanted, basically what happened, I had a herniated disc in my neck and it was pressing right on the nerve of whatever gives you the power in your arm, my right arm. So, you know, I had tests and there were various electrical tests and things they did where things just weren't reacting at all. So I knew it was bad. And I had further MRI scans and things, and they said, actually, it's got worse. So I had to make the decision. I didn't really have a choice. Maybe I could have gone on playing the swan or something forever, but that wasn't really what I wanted to do.
That's a terrible fate for any musician, surely. But it must have been really, really difficult. The thing that the amount of time you need to invest to become a player of your standard. You've never done anything else in your life. I mean, obviously, you kind of expanded on your repertoire and embraced all kinds of forms. But, you know, I just wonder how that felt, Julian, to make the decision that you were going to have to give up the cello.
Well, I was forced to make that decision. I mean, there were extraordinary things going on. I was being offered some incredible concerts, things I've wanted to do all my life, like play Shostakovich in Moscow. You know, those are the kind of things you kind of dream of doing. And I had to actually lie to my manager because I kept hoping that I was going to get, that we'd find some cure or something could be done. And I was accepting these concerts, but I knew kind of at the back of my mind, I was almost certainly going to have to cancel them, which is what happened. But it got to the point, one concert in the rehearsal, I was playing with orchestra. And I just thought, look, this isn't right. You know, I can't give my best at it. It's cheating. It's cheating the audience. So I just called it a day.
And how did you reconcile yourself to that? I mean, you're married to a cellist, which can't have helped. In fact, must have exacerbated that sense. I mean, how do you watch Jashin play and not think, that should be me there?
Now you're going into some detail here. You know, it is sometimes difficult. I mean, she's a lovely cellist. She's a very fine musician. At the time, we were doing a lot of these concerts together, and we'd actually made two full-length recordings together. And I, believe it or not, I felt sorry for her because we were doing these concerts, and she hadn't been long here from New Zealand, and she came over basically to marry me. And suddenly all this was taken away. So I really felt terrible for her. In some ways, maybe that helped me. I don't know. I mean, you can't really look at it, but it was a difficult situation.
It's a very romantic story, your getting together with your cellist wife, which kind of, you know, was drawn out. It was almost Victorian in its early, the duration of the early romance, isn't it?
I don't know. In what sense Victorian?
Well, didn't you meet? You met, and then 2 years later, you got back in touch. And then, I mean, yeah. You know, these days people hook up after 2 minutes.
Yeah. No, shall we say it was a slow burner because she was in New Zealand and I was in London. And basically, when I first met her, she was, you know, she's quite a lot younger than me. She was particularly young then. She was a student, and it just didn't really occur to me that this romance could develop. Then I think when I met her for the third or even fourth time in New Zealand, I thought, actually, maybe this can work.
I think you went on a car drive together, didn't you, and realised that there was a lot more between you than perhaps you thought.
Let's say we had time to talk.
You had time to talk. Let's say that. And you've also had time to tackle, I suppose, partly as a result of this tragedy that's kept you from the cello. You've had time to tackle all kinds of other issues. And I know that, as you've mentioned a couple of times, you're particularly passionate about making sure that young people are exposed to classical music and get to learn to play it. Tell me a little bit about your 30 under 30 list.
Well, there's that. You know, in many ways, I was quite lucky to, dare I say, to have a second string to my bow because I was very involved with music education, had been for a long time. And that enabled me, just a year after I stopped playing, to get the job of principal at the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, which is a wonderful establishment. Of course, it meant I was surrounded by wonderful musicians, again, young, wonderful musicians, which has always been a passion for me. So I did that job for 5 years. And during actually the end of my time at Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, COVID came. And I saw firsthand how terrible it was for all the students. They weren't able to do their graduations. They weren't able to do everything they'd worked towards for the 4 years they'd been there. And I was very aware of of course, my wife as well, not being able to give her concerts. I was thinking, you know, what's going to happen to all these really outstanding young musicians who don't have any work. They can't share their talents. All the things that they've worked towards for years are suddenly taken away from them. So I actually went to Classic FM with the idea of focusing on 30 young artists under 30 and playing their recordings and all this thing. And then Sky Arts came in on it, and we've done now two series with six of the musicians, and we're going to do a third. So it's basically focusing the spotlight on young talent and really giving them a platform. And it's going really well.
Well, I must make it clear, your wife may be young, but she's not under 30. But you are also going to be working with her again, happily, on a tour next summer, which is going to see you take the role as narrator, going into the history of Bach and some of his most well-known cello pieces, accompanied by your wife's performances. So that's very exciting indeed. And Julian, today is Blue Monday. I don't know if you know that, but it gave me a chance to play New Order, because it's supposed to be the most depressing, the day of the year on which we are most depressed, the most depressing day of the year, and I've been looking for other tunes.
For something to play, then play, yes. Sort of Spring by Vivaldi, Four Seasons. You know, I was interested to hear the interview, your last interview. Actually, I had an extraordinary. I hope you don't mind me digressing.
No,
I had
digress.
An extraordinary, little episode last night in Piccadilly. I was walking my 11-year-old daughter. And there was this group of four, you know, young guys, probably teenage guys. And one of them came over and said, is that your daughter you're with? You know? And I said, yeah. And then he said, well, she's very beautiful. I said, I know she is. And then he said, how old is she? I said, 11. And he kind of went, oh, my God. So that, you know, shows you something that it's perhaps, and this was in the middle of Piccadilly. So I'm just wondering if you know, we'd been somewhere else where there weren't cameras everywhere and wasn't brightly lit streets.
Did it feel like an intimidating or threatening situation?
Well, perhaps because of where we were, it didn't. But I think in a quieter surrounding, darker streets, I think it could have done.